From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, we take a swing at the question, why do we run?
It is 5:50 in the morning, and I'm heading out the door for 10 miles down with the folks at the Berkeley Running Club.
Okay, all right. Our route is the normal 10-mile route. We go along the lake, get down to the farmer's market, along John Nolan, that'll be the 5-mile marker, and up Edgewood Hill, and back to Berkeley.
All right.
Okay?
Sounds good. And we're off.
Good morning.
That's Dan Vimont with friends from the Berkeley Running Group in Madison, Wisconsin, on their usual Saturday morning run. Today, it's 10 miles. We'll check in with them later this hour as we ask the question, why do we run? For some of us, running means pleasure, a physical high. For Kenyans, the fastest people on earth, it's a way of life. For John Carlos, bronze medal winner in the 200-meter dash at the 68 Olympics in Mexico City, it was an opportunity to raise social awareness. He and gold medalist Tommy Smith raised their fists in the Black Power salute in a moment that became the most defiant and controversial in Olympics history.
Back on the track, and yet another record about to be smashed for 200 meters. Smith of America first through the tape, Australia's Norman second, third Carlos of the United States. The time, an incredible 19.8. The victory ceremony, unfortunately overshadowed by politics.
Carlos remembers that moment and the fallout that came later in the book The John Carlos Story. He told Steve Paulson that the moment was inspired by a meeting with Martin Luther King Jr.
I went into the room, and many of the people in the room looked familiar based on what my parents used to see on TV relative to Southern Christian leadership. But yet and still, while I'm sitting there nervously looking to see what's going to take place, I still didn't put the dots together in my mind in terms of where I was or what was about to happen to me in my life. And about 20 minutes later or so, Dr. King walked out of the room. My lip just fell all over the floor in terms of me being in a room with somebody that my mom always revered as God's first lieutenant that he sent here to earth to try and deal with the issues. And here I'm sitting in the room. I'm thinking my mom needs to be a rock in my pocket or a bug on my lapel. She needs to be here. And he noticed right away that I was a little nervous about being in the room. And what I noticed about him is that he was very perceptive and at the same time very comedic. He was a jokester to the point where he cracked so many jokes to relax you. He relaxed me and others in there, I'm sure. And then when we went into the meeting, certain things that he said stuck out in my mind. Like, for instance, he made a statement that they sent a letter to him and told him that he had a bullet with his name on it and he wouldn't have to wait long for it. That stayed in my mind, in front of my mind. The second thing is, probably which was the most important thing relative to the meeting, was the fact that he was going to come out in support of the Olympic boycott. He felt that he didn't want to be in command. He wanted Professor Edwards to be in command, but he definitely wanted to be the support factor right up under Professor Edwards.
And did you support that? I mean, would you have supported a boycott of the Olympics, which would mean that you wouldn't be able to compete there?
That was my game plan to support, but I thought that we would have a unified effort in terms of a staging a boycott. In this meeting, things became crystal clear because Dr. King asked, was there any questions? I had two questions, quite naturally. The first question would be, Dr. King, if they threaten your life, why would you go back to Memphis if they threaten your life? And I recall I used to wear shades all the time, and they didn't dilate like they do now. And I remember pulling my shades down on my nose so I could look into his eyes. I wanted to see whether this man had any fear for the fact that someone told him that he was getting ready to leave this planet. I saw no fear whatsoever. He was as solid as a rock. And then beyond that, I saw that he had love for humanity. The love that I saw in his eyes was like he said, I didn't make a partial commitment. I made a total commitment. If I have to sacrifice my life for what I believe to be right, then so be it. So I was really struck by that. So I asked him, I said, why would you go back? And he said to me, he said, John, that's a very good question. He said, but I have to go back and stand for those that can't stand for themselves And John, I have to go back and stand for those that won't stand for themselves. And then in time goes by, you begin to realize those individuals that he was going back to stand up for was the sanitation workers. They wasn't all black sanitation workers. They wasn't all white sanitation workers. There was a multicultural involvement in the sanitation department at that particular time. And then it leads me farther to believe that Dr. King didn't die as a result of his civil rights activities. He died because he got involved in the economics of this country. So as the people here at Wall Street, the people here in Wisconsin or Chicago or Boston or wherever, they're concerned about the economics of this country because it's affecting everyone, just the same as Dr. King felt it was affecting the sanitation workers at that time.
Now, of course, the boycott didn't happen, I suppose partly because Dr. King had been killed. Well, no one really took leadership of this boycott.
Well, that was the second question I had to Dr. King. Did you ever play any sports? Did you play basketball? Did you box? Did you do anything? He said he couldn't shoot pool. My question was, why would you get involved in the Olympic boycott? And he said, John, he said, that's a better question. He said, just imagine you being out in the middle of a lake, and the lake is still and serene. He said, and you reach down and you pull out a rock and you drop it in the lake. He asked me, he said, what happens? I said, it vibrates. He said, yes, it's waves. He said, the waves go out to the far ends of that lake. He said, that Olympic boycott is that rock. He said, if you guys chose to back up, opposed to going to the Olympic Games, he said, would make a statement that would ripple throughout the world as to what would make these individuals step back and give up something that they've trained for all their lives. Something must be wrong. Let's have some sort of dialogue and try and have understanding. But many individuals felt that they've worked so hard to win a gold medal or to win a medal at the Olympic Games. This is something that's inbred into young individuals. You know, the Olympics, go for the gold. You know, it's a glorifying situation. So, therefore, it was very difficult for many of them to say, I'm willing to sacrifice my 15 minutes in the sun. And we felt that we didn't have the right to tell them, you must not go to the Olympic Games. But what we did feel was we had the right to sit them down and let them know both sides of the table in terms of what you're getting in your 15 minutes in the sun and what you could possibly do for humanity, for your kids and your grandkids in terms of making it a better world for all people. But the overwhelming factor is that those individuals felt compelled to go to the Olympic Games. Now, when they decided to go, the question for me was whether I was going to stay home, because I could have quite naturally stayed home. But I felt to myself after thinking about it that had I stayed home, the United States at that time was the greatest country in the world as far as track and field is concerned. Someone from the United States would go and win a medal in my place, get on the victory stand. I really don't believe that they would have gotten up there and represented John Collins the way he felt he needed to be represented at that time. So I was compelled to go to the games.
So take me to the games. It was you and Tommy Smith were two of the fastest 200-meter runners in the world at that time. There was a good chance you were going to win medals, get up onto the podium.
Well, you know, any great athlete, you know, when I say great, I mean super great. If you're going to have a bad day, God will let you know when you get out of bed that morning that you're going to have a bad day. We had no qualms or no hesitation about us making the team. We knew that we would make the team. And I told Tommy at the quarter semi, after the quarter semi was over, we had a discussion, and I told him I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. And I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? He said, I'm with you. From that point on, we started talking about what artifacts we had we could bring to the table, which was the black gloves, which was a black scarf, which I had a black shirt. I had beads. We decided we would wear black socks out there with our pants rolled up. We had no shoes out there. And each and every one of these symbols had a specific meaning. And if you bear me the time, I'll explain them to you. The black glove was based on the fact that we felt with an open fist, there's five people of color, and each one of them are very sharp, have a very strong paradigm as to how things could be better. But either one of them step out on his own to move a pebble, he couldn't move it. But then when you say, all right, the next time we come together and say we have a unified vision as to how we can make things better, such as a possibly a boycott or what have you, and all these people come together in a very powerful force, well, you couldn't move a pebble by yourself. Now, unified, you can move a mountain. That was the concept of the fist and the glove. The scarf on Tommy's neck was to show black pride. I had a black shirt over my USA jersey to indicate that there was sorrow about the fact that we had to go to this extent to get America to wake up and realize its misdeeds in society. Then we decided that the beads that I had on my neck would be for all of the lynchings that had taken place that I've read about and heard about as a young kid coming up in this great country of ours. And then we wore no shoes with long black socks to indicate those individuals that was in the South at that particular time, and I'm sure they're still there today, walking to and from 10, 20 miles to school without shoes. We wore the Puma shoe, or we put the Puma shoe out there merely because the Puma shoe was a shoe that was a concern about people of color that didn't have the means to go out and buy the proper shoes, but they was very kind-hearted to give individual shoes before they even got a reputation.
So you did all this. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary what you're describing. The symbolism there is overpowering. You got the bronze. Tommy got the gold. Peter Norman from Australia got the silver. All up on the podium there. And then when they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, you and Tommy raised your fists.
We walked out, I mentioned to Tommy that, hey, man, you remember when we go out there, I said, people are going to be applauding, and then there's going to be a void, and that void would be total silence because they would be in a state of shock once we started to perform our deeds. And at the same time, I told Tommy, remember, we've been threatened. Our lives have been threatened. So remember this, man.
Well, why had you been threatened?
Well, based on the fact that we was proposing an Olympic boycott. They felt it was anti-American, you know, and many of the haters out there didn't particularly like the fact that you would step back. They feel that, oh, we giving you this honor. No, you didn't give me an honor. You set a standard. I took the honor to step up and qualify to make the Olympic team. I want America to represent young individuals in regards to what their ethnic background is as much as these young individuals honor America. That's what our stand was then. That's what my stand is today. So when we went out there, I told Tommy, be careful, man. We've been trained to listen to the gun. If you hear the gun, hit the deck. We went out there. We put the shoe down on the victory stand as they acknowledged us. Tommy, I believe, raised his glove and the shoe on his foot up to the spectators. And then when we received our medals and we turned to the right to the flag and they started to sing the national anthem, and then we come out with the gloves and raise our fists to the sky. And it's just like I said, this void came over to the point where it was silent for a matter of seconds. And then it went from silence to total screaming of the national anthem. It's almost like they were singing the national anthem in a sense that we're going to shove this American national anthem down your throats whether you want it or not.
And then you got booed, right?
Oh, it was a tremendous amount of boos.
What was the fallout for you personally? I mean, for starters, just as an athlete, weren't you kind of ostracized by the track and field establishment?
Well, I was ostracized to a sense, you know, but I wasn't weak enough that they could run me away. I decided that I was going to run for 2 years, and I always thought about how they tried and slammed down our throats that national anthem, and I wanted to slam down their throats that I was going to be the best in the world. Anybody you bring, I was going to wear them out for you to let them know I'm here to run, and I'm here for anybody you want to bring against me. But yet and still, you know, I had aches and pains relative to the demonstration. I would say that probably the most important thing that was most hurting or disturbing to me when my first wife took her life as a result of the Olympics, the pressures that were put upon us, the lack of money into our household, the contempt that came into our household.
No, and you should elaborate on that because, I mean, reading your book, the FBI followed you.
Oh,
they would plant rumors about you. You
put
got
rumors
death
out.
Threats.
Well, it's no different than what they do today to anyone. They did the same thing to Dr. King. And then at the same time, my kids had to endure our ridicule in school merely because when the teachers found out they were my kids. So I had to endure all of these things. I remember I had to get $100 here, $200 there, and get somebody to drive me to Vegas just so I could roll the dice to pay my mortgage. 29 days out of the month. If it was 30 days, I'm working 29 days to get my mortgage payment so my kids wouldn't live in the street. And I remember chopping up my furniture, taking my kids and tell them, take your clothes out of the bureau drawer and put it on the floor there. And I would go take a claw hammer and chop that furniture up and go put it in the fireplace because I could not pay my electric electric bill. I didn't have groceries. I had some dear friends that came and said, John, I don't have much, but I see you don't have nothing in your cabinets, and came and put food in my house. Many individuals walked away from me at that particular time that I thought was my friends. It took me a minute to find out that they walked away not because of disrespect or dislove. The majority of them walked away for fear of reprisal. If you was associated with John Collis, what's happening to him can come and happen to you as well.
Did you ever have any regrets for what you did back in Mexico City?
No regrets whatsoever. And if it was necessary for me to step up tomorrow, I would never hesitate to step up for what I feel is right. People say, you sound like you're still running. Sound like you still got the fire. Well, the fire was with me when I came, the fire being with me when I left, until justice is brought here for all men, women, and children on this planet. Someone has to step up in order to make it better. What good is my life being here if I'm here and I got kids and grandkids coming into this world, and I'm in a position where I could bring attention to something to try and make us solve this problem or make it a better situation, and now I'm getting ready to leave and I haven't done anything to try and make a better life for my kids or their kids? That's what it's about.
Thank you.
Right on.
John Carlos won the bronze medal for the 200 meters in the 68 Olympic Games. He's the author of The John Carlos Story. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, why ferrets don't run marathons. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You know, a picture's worth a thousand words. That's why we thought it would be fun and educational to publish a comic book to go along with our upcoming series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness. We'll explore some heavy subject matter in a new way. Go to ttbook.org to watch our video about the making of the comic book and find out how you can help. Why do you run? Let us know by sending email through our website, ttbook.org. You'll also find links for TT Book on Facebook and Twitter. For some runners, there's an extra incentive for finishing that 10-mile run, that elusive beast known as runner's high. Not everyone who runs gets it. It seems to come and go for those who do. And science doesn't yet know the magic spell that brings it on. But Dave Reichlin at the University of Arizona, Tucson, is getting closer. He's looking at runner's high from an evolutionary perspective, by studying people, dogs, and ferrets. Reichlin told Ann Strainchamps about the history of runner's high.
The term runner's high was really popularized in, sort of newspaper articles and things like that. And it does, in some ways, mimic the way people feel after taking certain kinds of drugs. And we think, at least the best evidence is that these feelings that are associated with positive changes in mood and well-being after exercise are actually caused by chemicals that your body makes that mimic the action of certain drugs.
Well, how much do we know about the physiological process or the biochemistry? I mean, specifically, what's going on in the body that produces that runner's high?
Well, we know that following and during and after aerobic activity, your body produces a few different compounds. One is one that we've studied, the endocannabinoid system, and endocannabinoids are sort of your body's form of marijuana. They activate the same receptors in your brain as marijuana activates. Another group of compounds are opioids, and these compounds activate the same receptors in your brain that opioids activate. And so if you produce these chemicals during and following aerobic activity, then you're going to get similar sensations to taking these types of drugs.
Why do some people seem to be able to get runner's highs and others don't? Because I imagine everybody who runs would really like a runner's high.
Absolutely, and that's a great question. You know, I think about it in a couple ways. First, I've never heard anybody finish a good exercise bout and not feel better psychologically afterwards. So if we think about the runner's high as being sort of a milder improvement in your mood and sense of well-being, most people do experience that. There probably is a segment of the population that has trouble exercising at the kinds of intensities or durations that can actually generate some of these chemical changes. And for those individuals, then it would be very difficult to get those sensations. But that is a real open question and an important one, one that we want to keep looking at.
So you recently set out to answer a very specific question. You wanted to know if the runner's high, that neurochemical pleasure response we've been talking about, had anything to do with how our species evolved as runners. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. We were interested in whether these neurochemical changes might be a product of our evolutionary history.
And what made you think that might be the case?
Well, there's good evidence that our skeletons have evolved to support high levels of aerobic activity, and in some, at least at some parts of our skeletons, seem to be related to endurance running activity. So, so these higher levels of aerobic activity, including running, may have played a strong role in our evolutionary history. We see this in the fossil record going back almost 2 million years.
Are you saying that the humans you think are kind of, it's like hardwired to be runners?
That's a possibility, and I think our research begins to support that idea that not only was our skeleton changed to be highly active, but perhaps some of our neurochemistry was changed over evolutionary time to support these higher levels of activity. And, you know, we see this not only in humans, but we also see the same kind of neurochemical activity in another mammal that we think is a great endurance exerciser, and that's the dog. We see similar changes in these endocannabinoid levels, these neurochemicals responsible for rewards after running in dogs as well. So we think that's some evidence that selection might be using this reward mechanism in multiple species to produce these endurance exercise activities.
Okay, so that was the question. So now tell me what you did to begin to tease this out. You designed this study with dogs and people.
Sure.
and then an unlikely animal.
That's right. Yeah, we had to compare dogs and humans, two animals that run long distances or exercise a lot, to an animal that in its natural habitat doesn't exercise very much, doesn't engage in aerobic activity. So we chose ferrets. So ferrets in their natural habitat are not endurance athletes in any way.
I've never had a ferret. What are they like?
I mean, you know, I love ferrets, and they're a lot of fun, and they make great pets, but you don't want them running a marathon.
How did you set about studying this question about the runner's high with your dogs and your humans and your ferrets?
Right. So what we had to do was have all the subjects, the humans, dogs, and ferrets, exercise on a treadmill for 30 minutes. And we collected blood samples before and after they exercised to measure changes in these chemicals, specifically endocannabinoids, before and after the exercise bouts. And we had them exercise at this sort of moderate running intensity. And we also had them, well, we had the humans and dogs walking. The ferrets were not so cooperative about the walking. So we actually just had them rest for 30 minutes. But we compared endocannabinoid levels after low intensity and high intensity exercise.
And so you wound up letting the ferrets just have a 30-minute rest time?
That's right. That's right. Low-intensity rest as our control.
So you had the humans and the dogs and the ferrets working out or resting, and then you took some blood samples, and what did you find out?
Well, we found in humans and dogs, we found that 30 minutes of running leads to a significant increase in a specific type of endocannabinoid called anandamide. So anandamide levels in the blood go up significantly. Following walking in humans and dogs, we saw no significant increase in endocannabinoid levels. The ferrets, as we predicted for an animal that doesn't generally engage in endurance activity, following running didn't show any change in endocannabinoid levels and also didn't following the control rest experiment. So in our groups that we think have an evolutionary history as endurance athletes, we see this change in endocannabinoid levels following endurance activity.
So basically, evolution has provided the dogs and the humans with a reward mechanism for exercising, and the ferrets, you know, unfortunately, don't get any rewards for exercising.
Right, right. Yeah, no, and our study is sort of the first step in showing that evolutionary story. But yeah, that is our hypothesis, that this is a product of selection for endurance activities.
Well, what do you think would be the evolutionary benefit of running?
Well, what people have suggested for humans is that running sort of these high-intensity aerobic activities would have been used to gain access to a new food product out on the landscape in Africa around 2 million years ago, and that's animal protein. So we think that our ancestors were using these behaviors to either gain faster access to scavenged meat or, in some cases, to actually hunt prey animals using a technique called pursuit hunting.
So you've painted a kind of evolutionary story of how it might be that humans have this biological imperative, this reward mechanism for running. That said, why are so many humans sedentary then? You'd think we'd all be out running.
Right. Well, that's the big question that we need to answer is, at what point do humans exercise enough to sort of adhere to a program and get those feelings that make them want to continue? We know that many people, when they start an exercise program, quit very quickly, and people who get past a certain point in time will start to exercise regularly, and they end up getting to a point where they can't imagine their lives without it. And so it may be that if you start off sort of as a sedentary individual, it's very hard to get to the point where you start getting these rewards. But that, again, that's really the million-dollar question, is understanding what's happened to humans to make us enjoy our inactivity more than our activity.
Yeah, I suppose one question you might have is, are humans turning into ferrets?
I hope not, but that's something that, you know, I think that's something that we need to avoid. It is sort of a public health question at this point, as, you know, the more people engage in active lifestyles, the better off we are in terms of public health. And so it is a very important question that needs to be addressed of how to get people to adhere to these exercise programs that are so beneficial.
Dave Reichlin studies runner's high at the University of Arizona, Tucson, where he's a professor of anthropology and a runner.
The immediate question is,
is there a runner's high?
Oh, that's a different question. Okay. Then.
What is it like to be a ferret?
Now the question is, how do they get the running shoes on them?
Forget about running shoes on ferrets. How do we talk ourselves into putting them on and getting some exercise? Gretchen Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times. She's compiled the latest in exercise science in the book The First 20 Minutes. Anne Strangeshamps checked in with her.
Well, Gretchen, there's been a lot of attention paid lately to humans as a running animal. I mean, some people even say we were born to run, designed to run. Do you think that's true?
The science actually doesn't really support that idea that we're born to run. It appears both from the fossil record and from sort of anecdotal evidence that we actually are born to walk. We're much more efficient. The human structure, the skeleton, is much more efficient at walking than at running. When they bring people and other animals into the lab and put all of us, the people and the other mammals, on treadmills and test how well we move, humans are exceptionally good at walking. We are better than almost any other mammal in terms of how well we use energy, and we're really poor in terms of running. We're not nearly as fast or as efficient or as speedy as most other mammals. We just like doing it.
And at the same time, I think of running as just walking but speeded up.
Well, yes and no. It actually is a different stride. When you walk, one of your feet is always on the ground. And when you run, there is a period when you're not. And for whatever reason, we are actually not as efficient as four-legged mammals at running. We can outwalk them by a long ways.
It seems to me that in some ways, there has never been a better time to run. I mean, practically every week there's a new study or some new research out that sheds new light on the physiology or the biochemistry of running. And for exactly the same reason, there's never been a worse time to run, because we are just presented with a barrage of new information all the time. Is there a consensus emerging about best practices?
I will say what seems to be emerging is what common sense would probably have told us, which is the human body definitely needs to be moving, and running is a really good way in a concentrated period of time to move. But the best science suggests that moderation, unsurprisingly, is the ideal approach to running. There was a really interesting study that was presented at the most recent meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine that looked at how much running is best for your lifespan, meaning what amount of running will give you the potentially the longest lifespan. And it wasn't a lot of running. It was running about 3 miles, four, maybe five times a week at a pretty slow or at least moderate pace of about 10 to 11 miles per hour, which is, for a really serious runner, would be considered slow. For me, it's now rather fast. But that's a really manageable amount of running. There's some evidence that doing a lot more running may not necessarily be healthy, and doing a whole lot less, you won't get quite as many health and fitness benefits. But that moderate amount of running appears to be the absolute sweet spot.
Mm. You titled your book, The First 20 Minutes, sort of suggesting for those of us like me who have to force ourselves to exercise that perhaps 20 minutes would be enough. Is that true?
Yes, although it depends on what your goal is for exercise. And that's a really important message, that if your goal is to be healthy, to have less risk of heart disease, diabetes, dementia, obesity, if that is your goal, then it appears that the first 20 minutes of moving will provide most of those health benefits. And that's any type of moving. It doesn't have to be running. Walking, cycling, going upstairs, gardening, any type of human movement is really important for health. And most of the benefits of exercise or activity in general are gathered in the first 20 minutes compared to sitting on the couch.
And do those 20 minutes have to be consecutive? What about the suggestion that it's okay to break it up and do it in 10-minute chunks?
Yes, there's some very good science suggesting that what scientists call fractionalized bouts of exercise, which means 10 minutes at a time, even 5 minutes if that's all you can manage. If you get, say, 3 10-minute bouts, 2 10-minute bouts during a day, you will get most of the health benefits, probably all of the health benefits of 20 or 30 minutes consecutively.
And then for those of us who would like to get really efficient about exercising, there's this high-intensity interval training that turns out to be really effective. But the bad news part is that it's really got to hurt. Can you tell me about this?
High-intensity interval training is great for both health and fitness. What it means is essentially you do short bouts of hard work, meaning you run or cycle or swim hard for 1 minute, then go easy for 1 minute, go hard for 1 minute, easy for 1 minute. If you can do that 10 times, which would be 20 minutes, with a short, say, 5-minute warm-up, 5-minute cool-down, then in 30 minutes, you can get both the health and the fitness benefits, scientific studies have shown, of about 90 minutes of much slower endurance exercise. So if you want to be both more healthy and fitter, then, and you have
in less
very
amount
of
time,
yes, then all you need to do, and this is a big all, is make yourself be really uncomfortable for about a minute at a time.
How uncomfortable? I mean, when you say exercise hard for a minute at a time, how hard?
Well, in the scientific studies, it was at least 90% of their heart rate maximum, which you can determine by using formulas, but you can also just be honest with yourself. You want it to be about a 9 on a scale of 1 to 10 of how hard this feels. And they have found in a number of studies that if people are honest with themselves, they usually can tell whether they're at about 90% of their maximum.
That's when you feel like you're about to have a heart attack, right?
Yes, but it's only for a minute. And what's interesting is when they have asked people, their subjects afterwards, did you like this kind of exercise, this intense exercise? They almost always said they liked it better than longer, slower exercise because it got done quickly.
As we move ever further down the path of creating a culture that is almost entirely sedentary, in the sense that, you know, most of our jobs increasingly don't necessitate movement. Most of them involve sitting in front of a computer screen. So is there a kind of basic bottom line, like what do you need to do to keep all of those physical systems and mental systems in good shape?
That's actually a really interesting question, because there is a difference between exercise and just being in motion. That's one of the things I found most interesting in the reporting that I've done, is there's a whole new understanding that sitting a lot, even if you regularly exercise, is very unhealthy. There's a modern phenomenon that's called the active couch potato. And that is many of us, actually, including me. And that's people who may exercise at lunchtime and then sit the entire rest of the day. That's really unhealthy. The exercise will not completely undo the health problems of sitting for 8-10 hours a day, which is average for Americans.
Gretchen, I'm paid to sit for 8 hours a day. What are we supposed to do?
Well, and I'm paid to sit and write about exercise. what happens when you sit for really extended periods of time is a number of systems start malfunctioning in your body. You start producing less of an enzyme that breaks up fat in your bloodstream. That fat then goes to your muscles, your heart, your liver. You also, the big muscles in your body are not contracting, so you're not pulling as much blood sugar out of your blood. So you start having too much insulin. That's the beginning of type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance.
Hence the rise in diabetes in the U.S.
Yes, including among people who exercise. The answer is actually surprisingly simple. Stand up. There's very good and growing evidence that standing up about every 20 minutes is really important for good health. And it doesn't mean that you have to do anything while you're standing up. You don't have to jog in place. You don't have to run. You don't have to do jumping jacks. You can if you choose to, and if your coworkers will put up with it. But there have been a number of studies that have found that if you stand up about every 20 minutes for, say, 2 minutes, the big muscles in your legs and your back will contract. That increases the amount of enzymes that break up fat. It means you're pulling more blood sugar. They have found that just standing up more often reduces heart disease risk and diabetes risk. It also has been found to help with weight control. If you sit unendingly for hours, for 6-7 hours, there are implications for weight gain. So stand up. It's so easy.
Gretchen Reynolds is a runner and writes the Phys Ed column in the New York Times, which appears on the Well blog online. Her new book is called The First 20 Minutes.
All right. Here's where we try and keep up with Travis. Travis is a hill guy. So I gotta get Travis starting to talk up this hill so he slows down.
Almost done, guys.
Mile 15 for you, Dave?
14, coming up to 15.
All right.
In the corner here. Good job, guys.
I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, cracking the code on the fastest people on Earth. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Adirinand Finn had always been a runner, wavering between serious and recreational. After entering and winning a race in his hometown of Devon, England, Finn decided it was time to train again. The Kenyans, he thought, some of the fastest people in the world, would be the perfect training partners. So he went to Kenya to run seriously and to try to unlock the secrets of speed. He writes about his time there in the book Running with the Kenyans. Shortly after arriving in Kenya, Finn felt confident and decided to enter a local cross-country race.
I don't hear the starting pistol, but suddenly we're off. My plan is to stick at the very back of the field, but it's as though I've been shot and I'm falling backwards through the air as they all charge off. I'm sprinting, trying to stay upright, but it's no good. It's like a bad dream where your legs won't move. At the first corner, there's a lot of congestion in front of me, so I manage to catch up with the tail end of the field. As we head past the stand for the first time, I'm nicely tucked in. There are almost 400 runners ahead of me, but I'm sure some people have started too fast and that I'll soon begin picking them off. But it's me who has started too fast, and soon I'm struggling to stay with anyone. I battle to keep up with an elderly man in front of me, but he's too strong. Halfway round the third lap, the leaders hurtle by to lap me. One after another, they fly by. It makes me feel even slower. I'm sure people are laughing now. There's a fine line between humbling and humiliating. I think I've just crossed it.
So just how fast are the Kenyans?
The Olympics in Beijing was Kenya's best ever Olympics. The World Championships last year on the track and field World Championships was their best ever track and field championships. Last year in the marathon, which, you know, they just completely dominated. They won all five major marathons. Of the top 25 official times in the world, not counting Boston, were all by Kenyan runners.
So the thing is that, I mean, that means that for 20, 30, 40 years, we've been watching Kenyan runners be the best anywhere. And yet, does anyone know what it is that makes them so fast?
Well, they just have built this, for reasons of various reasons, like there are very few other options open to them. You know, it's their only way out. They see all around them, they see so many successful athletes disappearing abroad, winning races. And the kind of money you win in track and field is not huge for a European or an American, but for a Kenyan, even winning a small race somewhere in Europe or US is a big deal when they come back to Kenya. You know, they've got enough money to buy a farm, buy a car. So people are just seeing running success everywhere. So for various reasons, there's this real drive towards running. And these people, even though they've got very little, they will just dedicate their lives to running to the level which is very unusual in the West. I mean, you'd have to be a very, very, very top level professional athlete to even come close to the levels of dedication these guys are living with. I mean, they just run, sleep and eat. That's all they do all day. They don't have jobs, they don't help the family. They just live in these training camps and they just run and run and run. And there's thousands of them doing this. So it's in some ways, it's simply a numbers game, but a numbers game of people at the very, very top.
You've learned a lot, of course, over the last few years in how you learn to run a little better by being there, by training there. What was it that really took you to Kenya? Did you hope to learn to run barefoot? Did you hope to discover the secrets of the Kenyans? Or was it just an adventure?
Well, it was a bit of everything. I mean, the original impetus, so despite the fact that I'd had this lifelong fascination, the thing that suddenly made me go, yes, I'll do it, is my sister-in-law moved to Kenya, and she got involved with organizing this marathon out there. And it's run through a wildlife conservancy, and the lions are out roaming free, and they have these helicopters patrolling the skies, which swoop down and scare the animals off if they come too close. And she kept saying, you've got to come and run this race.
Part of the magic of the story that you tell is that this is a marathon unlike any that most Europeans or Americans are likely to experience. This marathon that you were going to train for and run in is through a wild area, isn't it? And there are lions and not tigers and bears, I guess, but lions and cheetahs out there.
Yeah, lions, cheetahs, leopards. And it's actually right on the spot where my sister-in-law lived. And when we first got to Kenya, we spent a week there and we saw them wandering around. So, you know, I could definitely vouch that they were there.
So tell me about your training program. How did you first set about training in Kenya?
Well, in some ways, the biggest challenge for me was how was I going to keep up with these guys, because there was a huge gulf in talent. And the first thing I did, I just turned up. Someone told me that they meet every morning at 6 o'clock. There's these big groups, and there's a certain points in the town where I was living where they would meet at 6 a.m., like 5 mornings a week. So I turned up at one of these groups. There were maybe 60, 70 athletes, and we just all headed off together out into the country. And, stupidly, I didn't even know how far we were going. And after about 10 minutes, I asked someone how far we were going. They said 1 hour 10. So that still didn't, explain it to me. And we were disappearing off into the African, countryside. I'd only been there a week, and I was like, oh God, where are we going? And they just got faster and faster and faster. They started off at quite a good pace. But luckily, there were a couple of women at the back of the field who were struggling with the pace as well. So the three of us stuck together at the end, and I was dropping off from them, but they kept encouraging me to keep up.
You had also, had you not, switched from athletic shoes to sort of modified barefoot running?
Yeah, I mean, there's a massive trend in the West anyway at the moment to run in these minimalist or barefoot shoes, which mimic running barefoot. The scientists who came up with this idea that this was the best way to run basically came up with their theory by studying Kenyan runners. And so when I heard that, I thought, well, I want to do everything that the Kenyans are doing, so I'm going to learn to run in this barefoot style. And I did that before I got to Kenya, because it takes a little bit of transitioning to change your running style. So I just about got that together, and I arrived in Kenya quite excited to be running with all these barefoot Kenyans. And there were no barefoot Kenyans running anywhere, and that was a major surprise for me.
They all had the big cushy shoes on.
They did, and there's various reasons for it. And the barefoot thing does still count, because what happens is the Kenyans all grow up running barefoot. If you go to the school races, they're all running barefoot. So even when they put the shoes on, they've learnt to run in this barefoot style, and the shoes just don't seem to make that much difference to them.
You put a team together to run in this big race. Can you tell us about some of them? They were not just men. You ran with both men and women, didn't you?
Yeah. You asked me earlier about how did I manage to train with the Kenyans, and one way I realised I could do this is if I set up a team, because then, they would be, in a way, it would be in their interest to train with me as well, because we were all a team. And I originally just wanted 2 or 3 guys. But once people knew I was setting up a team and that we were going to run this race, I mean, everyone in this town is desperate for a race, and I'd agreed to pay the entrance fees for the race for them. So suddenly everybody wanted me to be in the team. And before I knew it, I had like 7 athletes. But there were some great characters there. There was a guy called Christopher Chiboybotch, who had a few years before had come second in the New York Marathon and second in the Boston Marathon. And he was a little bit past his peak, but he was still a very experienced guy to have on the team. And then, like, just one guy who ended up being our star runner was just my neighbor. We just lived in a local house in a town, and this kid lived in the house next door, a young kid, which is just a shack. I mean, I'm sitting here in a tiny little studio in London, and his whole house was no bigger than this. But he was so friendly to me, and, he'd come up to me when we were out with the kids, and I just said, hey, do you want to be on the team? And, he ended up being a great runner. His name is Jafet, and he's a big star in the book.
Yeah. So how fast did it get better? Because it did get better. You developed your style, you developed your stamina. It all came together. Maybe you were not any longer believing that you were going to win that race, but it really did begin to come together for you.
It did. I mean, I ran the Lewa Marathon, it's this incredibly tough marathon. It's at 5,500 feet altitude. It's run in baking heat, and it's run on soft, sandy trails. And it was my first marathon, and I ran way too fast the first half. So I became completely dehydrated, almost hallucinating by the end. But I ended up being the first non-Kenyan runner in the race. And there were, the British Army were in the race. There was some, serious international, not international level runners, but runners from countries all around the world who'd made this pilgrimage to Kenya to run this race. So that was an achievement in itself. Then I ran the New York Marathon and broke 3 hours, which was, you know, before I'd started this whole thing, that seemed like a pretty serious level to be able to get to. And I'd gone from, you know, not brilliant, like a 1 hour 30 half marathon runner, to running 2:55 in New York in 6 months, basically. So, yeah, and since then I've got faster. I mean, I've continued learning and applying what I've learned, and I've since done half marathons in 1 hour 18, so 78 minutes, which for anyone who's run half marathons would say that's a fairly decent time. In Kenya, that's still a hopeless time. I mean, you know, I still get no credibility in Kenya for that time, but here in England, people normally nod and go, that's pretty good.
So did you come home from Kenya feeling as though you knew a little bit more? You were a little bit closer to discovering the secret of the Kenyan runners, the fastest runners on earth?
Yeah, I mean, the secret is there is no secret. You know, that's what I learned. But behind that, that sounds like a failure to find the secret. But what that means is that the reasons, they're not secret. They're there. They're laid out for everyone to see. And, you know, it's hard work. It's a lifetime of running. It's a dedication to running. It's, I mean, living at altitude. It's having these very strong feet and ankles from running barefoot for years. And just a focus and a will and a mentality that is very much, they're very confident but also relaxed people, which is a very good combination for running. So it's this whole mishmash of reasons, which is the secret itself.
Adirinand Finn is the author of Running with the Kenyans.
1 mile to go.
What's the song? Something to Brooklyn?
No sleep.
No sleep till Brooklyn.
Till Brooklyn.
Yeah, song.
Or I was with the Beastie Boys or the Flamers.
Are we going to the, are we taking a Roger?
We never go straight, we go forward, David. We go forward.
And yeah, we're in Wisconsin here after all.
No sleep till! Cause I'll be rocking this party 8 days away!
All the way to the finish line.
All right. All right. Nice run. Check off. Check it.
We've been following Dan Vimont as he goes on a 10-mile run with the Berkeley Running Group, organized by David Mixelsperger, owner of the Berkeley Running Store in Madison, Wisconsin. Dan completed the Boston Marathon on April 16th, 2012. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website, ttbook.org, where you can also find years of interviews in our archives. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Born to Run. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamp, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.